Thank you very much. It's a real honor to be here. Thank you for the invitation to speak. Congratulations to the award winners. And it's going to be fun to follow on Paul's talk. We corresponded as we thought about what we're going to speak on. And we also, I work with Sam Smith, so I have a pretty good idea of what she is going to talk about. So sandwiched in between, I'm trying not to overlap. So I thought I would tell you about some of my recent work studying methane hydrates in the Atlantic. And this is a little bit different. It's not the sulfide minerals, but these methane hydrate systems support chemosynthetic communities. So you're going to hear a little bit about that. I wanted to be true to the title of this session, and so I wanted to describe the system, talk about our discoveries, talk about the technology we use, and especially for the computer engineers here, the visualization challenges, the big data challenges that we have, that I have as a biologist anyway, that I hope the engineers of the future will help us solve. And then I thought I wanted to talk about exploitation and environmental management, but the fact is I only have two slides on those at the very end, so you'll know when I'm getting close to the end when I finally talk about those two aspects of this presentation. So what are methane hydrates? To back up. So you see this burning ice there. This is one of the classic pictures. I just was at a meeting this morning where they had a video. You go out on the ship, you collect the methane hydrate ice, and you can light it on fire and hold it in your hand. So it's pretty remarkable stuff, and it's an energy source. So we're very interested in it in terms of usable energy for human society. So methane hydrate is nothing more than a methane molecule or a hydrocarbon molecule locked in a water lattice, so it forms a crystal ice. Have you guys heard of this? It's everywhere in the deep sea on the continental slope, almost everywhere, and it's related to the bubbles that Paul was showing earlier. So the reason we find it in the deep sea is that ice has a stability. There's a point where it can form and stay stable, and that's at greater than 350 meters and temperatures of 0 to 4 degrees Celsius. So we find it at depths in the deep ocean below sunlight. And it's forming. Where's that methane coming from? In this case, on these continental margins, it's biogenic, meaning it's come from microbial degradation of organic material. So continental shelves, all the organic material from photosynthetic productivity in the water column and runoff from nutrient enrichment from land. You get a lot of productivity that falls to the seafloor over eons, and then it gets worked on by the microbes, turned into hydrocarbons. So that's kind of the general picture. And as I said, they're found around continental margins all over the globe. We don't know them very well. We really didn't begin to understand methane hydrates in the deep sea until, I guess, the 1990s, maybe around there. They are a fossil fuel reserve. If you look at this, I don't have the pointer. I can point. You can see gas hydrates. There's really very large, that's in billions of tons of carbon, far exceeds the reserves, the known reserves of oil, traditional energies. Thank you. Now I've got to be two-fisted. I've got to remember to hit the right thing. So there's a lot of it out there. What's the problem is we don't know how to extract it safely yet, and so this is the next challenge for us, and extract it commercially. This is what it looks like on the seafloor. So you're seeing exposed methane hydrate. This is a picture I took off of North Carolina. You can tell I'm American, right? So North Carolina coast. It looks like an upside-down snow cone, right? You want to put some grape juice on it and eat it. Here's another little bit exposed on the surface. This is looking down in sediment core, so this is more like what might be in the extractable zone. And then there's often gas underneath, free gas underneath this frozen ice. And then just another picture. It's ice. So I'm going to take you to our study site. So I'm really going to give you a case study of how we use technology, how I, as a biologist, use technology to study a deep ocean system. So we're going off North Carolina. These little red dots, each one is a diapir, a salt diapir. So there's a string of them going up the east coast of the U.S. And a salt diapir is a salt cone in sediment. And salt is more buoyant than the sediment. And so it is pushing up. So it makes this kind of dome. As it pushes up, it's squeezing the sediments and gas is escaping. All right, so the gas is getting up near the surface. This 996, that's an ocean drilling program, drill hole from back in the late 80s, I think. So that's the general site. And we studied it in the 2000s, early 2000s. We work a lot, very interdisciplinary work on the ship. It makes it a great deal of fun. So Matt Hornbach is a geophysicist, and he was using acoustic signals to penetrate the seafloor and look at what was underneath that hole 996. So ODP drilled the hole, but it was supporting a methane hydrate system. So what we see here is there's a known seep site that they drilled, and then you see these other pockmarks. There's four pockmarks here. And so we looked down below the seafloor, shallow seafloor, about 30 meters maximum, and we could see these holes. These are the conduits where the methane was rising up and escaping. So I said we had this one known site, and we'd studied it with a submersible. But here Matt was able to show, using this acoustics system, that there were probably three or four other sites in the same area. And we wanted for a decade to get back and look to see if there were more sites. And we had a chance to do that. And the way we went back, this is just wild technology. We used one of these AUVs that Paul mentioned. So we had Sentry, the autonomous vehicle that's operated by Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in the U.S. And we were working, we had a site down here at our Blake Ridge Diapir. We also worked at Cape Fear Diapir. So we hit two of those sites. Here's what this vehicle delivers. 6 terabytes of data from just 10 days on station. Remarkable amount of data. How in the world does one person deal with that, or one laboratory? It's just crazy. We covered 330 kilometers underwater and 68,000 seafloor photos. Tremendous amount of data acquisition. I wasn't on the ship. We did all of this from shore. I was the lead scientist, and we were based in Rhode Island. The ship was out there with a couple of engineers, operating the vehicle, maintaining the vehicle, but the main science team was on shore. So we're in what's called the Interspace Center at the University of Rhode Island. Paul mentioned that. And here we are. This is the shore-based laboratory. We have a quad screen where we can either pick one channel and watch the video, or we can watch all four screens. Now, an autonomous underwater vehicle, that means there's no tether. It is not transmitting data up to the surface. Pretty boring. What are you going to watch? You can watch the ship bouncing up and down. We saw it raining, the storms that come through. But basically, we were sitting there waiting for the data to come to us. So we would plan a mission. The mission would happen. They'd throw the AUV over the side at night. It would run its mission. We'd go back to our hotel. And then in the morning, we'd come in, 8 in the morning, and the data would all have been downloaded from the mission, and then the students started working on this. Now, this was an experiment. Nobody had ever done this before, and it sounds like, well, so what's the big deal? But if you're a professor and you know you're taking 10 people out to do this amazing project, you want to make sure everybody gets something out of it, right? And we had no idea if it was going to be the most boring thing, like watching paint dry. But these kids, here's our shore-based team here. I mean, this is at the end of the cruise, and we were just so proud of ourselves because it worked. These kids would get the data. They sunk their teeth. They'd never seen this before. They sunk their data into all these files, the pictures. They looked at every one of those 50, whatever it was, 1,000 photographs, categorized them, started identifying the invertebrates in them. They had chemical sensors on the vehicle that they were analyzing where the chemical plume signals were. Just an amazing amount of effort on the part of these kids. I think what made it work was it was a social group. So when we go to sea, we're used to being at sea, and we're all together, we're all doing one thing, and we're working really hard, and bonds form, the ideas pass around, and it's a very engaging, exciting, it's why those of us who do deep sea biology love it, because we get to go to sea. He's like, why would you do this sitting in Rhode Island and not get that social experience? But we created it. We generated it just among ourselves because we had one focus. That's all we had to do. There were no distractions. There was nothing else around on the campus at the time. It was summertime. And so we recreated that social experience, which I think was pretty cool. And then this is our shipboard-based team. I don't want to let them go by without a shout out, because they did a fantastic job just operating this vehicle. And you can see it's a very, very young crew, so it's really exciting to see the young engineers get in there and pilot these things, plan the missions, program them to do the work we want to do. So it's big data, a lot of pictures, and these are just a few to show you what it looks like when you have biology, and then it can start to get pretty dull when you just have mud. So on the left, our emissions for the one dye appeared. So we had a number of dives. There they are there, three, four, five dives. Different, they're color-coded. And we can, when we program the AUV, it's, you can make it very, very systematic, and you're just mowing the lawn. And you can tighten the lines depending on what you want to do. So where the tight lines are, we have photographic surveys, overlapping photos. With the AUV, you're quite close to the bottom, so you can fly 30 meters to the bottom with a high-resolution bathymetry system, multi-beam sonar system. And the sonar system, you can get these incredible maps, 30-meter relief. And so what we thought was a flat seafloor, all of a sudden you can start picking out these areas that are irregular. And those end up being, all four of those are new seep sites. Well, actually, this was the original main seep site, and then these other three were newly discovered seeps. So it was, all of a sudden, we could instantly recognize where seeps were just by mapping the seafloor here. We didn't even have to take a picture of it to know we had a seep. So here we have those seeps again. The other thing that's new that's happened in the past couple of years is we can now look at the water column from the ship and see the flares, the bubble plumes rising up from these seep areas. So now we don't even have to have a vehicle on the seafloor to find the seeps, but we do want to get vehicles down there just to study what's going on, study in more detail. So we have a line here, A to A prime. That's this line here. We can also, with sonar, look down below with acoustic signals, look down below the sediment surface and see what the structure underneath looks like. This is related to what we did earlier with the seeing those four conduits. So here we see these zones of transparency. So we're starting to put together this three-dimensional view of these seeps from the water column to the seafloor and then down below the seafloor. And one of the ideas is we want to add the fourth dimension, time, to see the dynamics. How do these conduits change over time? How do these plumes change? Are they continuous? Do they vary with different conditions on the seabed? And this is a video of bubbles in a different area, but this is, again, like Paul was showing you, that these bubbles, in this case, are just naturally streaming out. There's nobody punching a core in here. This is what's happening on the seafloor right now. And so it's a pretty interesting experience. This was a site discovered this past summer, and I saw it. This I saw from my office watching on the internet. So I was there when the discovery was being made, and that's how I knew where to go find the video. So like Paul said, this is a brave new world that we can now sit in our offices and work with teams on shore to study these things. Okay, so more about visualizing these systems. So you saw those bubble plumes. So this is looking with the side scan sonar, with the multi-beam sonar of the autonomous vehicle with Sentry flying low to the bottom, so we get really high resolution images. And you can see the bubble flares here, and there's bubble flares here. But look at this, there's this smog in the water. All of a sudden we can start to see, we think, what's going on as these bubbles rise up and dissolve and disperse. So we're getting signals here, but we don't know if that's the methane or if that's things that we're eating, the methane. So we need to go down and ground truth that. So there's always some next question after we start using new types of data. This is the first time anybody's ever made this kind of plot. So this was brand new on our cruise. And this is working with Mimi Lobecker in particular, was a really good acoustician. Often, the best fun is going out with engineers and people, computer scientists, who really know how to dig into the data, dig into the vehicles, and modify them and get us what we want. They love us biologists coming out and saying, can't you do this? And they say, well, let me figure that out. It's just amazing. Photomosaics, like you saw Paul's pictures. So here's carbonate rocks. That's what gives the relief on the seafloor. Here's a mussel bed. I guess we can see it with this light. So here's our study area again, all those Sentry missions. Here's some very high-resolution seafloor mapping. Again, you can see even more relief of those carbonate rocks. Here are the carbonate rocks with side scan sonar that shoots that looks out to the side rather than looking vertically, so getting the hard things show up bright. So you can see this little mound here. In a high-resolution version of this same image, you can actually pick out the mussels So individual muscles. So again, here we're developing technologies, these acoustic technologies that allow biologists to see things without actually having to have a camera there and get a very large scale sense of what's on the seafloor. And then in this image, it's just a little bit of, here's the biology in these blue and gray, a preliminary look. And then these green are chemical plumes, that chemical anomalies associated with these seep sites. So we're combining sensor data. So, you know, the magic for a young engineer or scientist is to figure out how to get all these different systems together in the same visualization and to bring it home so you guys see it instantly. Here we're just mapping the distribution of animals. This is our primitive look. This is the students identifying every single picture that had a clam or a mussel. So the mussels are all associated with the carbonates, and the clams are all in the periphery. But we can get a little bit more sophisticated in how we think of this using GIS tools, mapping tools, and interpolating data. So here we're looking at the carbonates. You see the little lumps of carbonates now. And we can add in where are the mussels. So there they're mapped onto the carbonates. Carbonate rocks are the green outlines. Mussels are the color gradient. Clams are, again, all over. So we can now start to quantify areas. You know, so we can say how much of the area is covered by clams. So if we know the size of the clams and the average biomass of a clam, we can start to get good quantitative measures out of these maps. And then finally, we looked at where the bacterial mats are. So we see that the carbonates, the mussels, and the bacteria are all together. So this idea of looking for methane hydrates is, for a long time, we only knew about the Blake Ridge site. But then this bubble prospecting tool that our colleagues have developed, looking at these bubble plumes, just running the ship over the surface of the sea and looking down into the seabed or seawater just above the seabed, we're now finding seep communities off of New England, off of Virginia. That was in 2012, and in summer 2013, apparently there have been many, many, many more of these seep sites located all up and down this region of the East Coast. So there's a lot of methane hydrate out there. We're starting to find these locations. For biologists, we're really interested now in how these systems are connected, what their biodiversity is like, are the same species occurring in these sites. It also is where we think about exploitation. So that's, as a biologist, I think about if we're going to extract these methane hydrates. This is a image of a Japanese test extraction preparing for commercial exploitation. So the Japanese have been able to successfully extract the methane hydrate. So we think it's on the horizon, and I don't know if it's decadal or less, that there'll be commercial operations. Which then raises the question of, if you start extracting these methane hydrates, will there be an impact on the biological communities? And the first step of that is understanding how industry is going to extract them. And there may be cases where they don't even come close to the chemosynthetic communities, and we don't have to worry. So we need to understand what the activity is and what the potential impacts are. And then the biologists think about things like, well, what's the distribution? How many of these seep sites are there really? Are they all have the same species composition? What's the biodiversity? What's the dynamics? Are they really stable? We think seep sites last for thousands of years. And if that's the case, then are the animals adapted to that kind of stable environment? Are the mussels we find, they're growing very slowly, and they're about this big, the mussels. Are they 100 years old? Are they 20 years old? Are they 1 year old? We don't have those dynamics yet. So we need to understand that. Special adaptations to living in this kind of environment, physiological adaptations, which might have other uses for society if we understand special enzymes that they might have. For instance, we might be able to model those or synthesize those. We're interested in how populations are maintained. That's what connectivity stands for. So if you have a bunch of mussels here, are their larvae serving as the source for populating other systems? So how resilient are they? If you destroyed one of these sites, how quickly would it come back? You still have the fluid flux with the methane coming up. Would the animals come back quickly, or would it take decades, years, decades? We don't know that for these systems, and we don't really know what these systems are doing for us in a natural sense. In fact, they might be mediating some of the Well, they're producing methane, which is a greenhouse gas, right? And so that gets converted into CO2 and eventually it's released into the atmosphere. So just thinking about modeling those dynamics is something ahead of us. So we've got a lot of work to do to understand these environments. We're going to learn a lot from the thinking of environmental management in the deep sea, which is what Sam Smith is going to talk to you about in a minute. And if I get my hand on the right button. So I just wanted to, like Paul, this is, like Paul said, this is not a single person can't do all of this. We rely on many, many, many people from the ship's officers and crews, the operators of the AUVs and ROVs, the engineers who are back in the, you know, on shore developing these systems. It's just a tremendous collaborative program. And I also a lot of the academic colleagues are help figure this out, and many, many students who get involved in this. So with that, I will thank you, and we can move on to the next talk. Thanks.